Back together again, you and I, Thursday, December 15th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. We featured more details on Governor Ned Lamont's push for a possible middle-class state income tax cut. Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence spokesperson Liza Andrews joined the show to talk about recent high-profile cases of domestic violence in the state, and a return visit from University of New Haven finance instructor David Sacco, offering his thoughts on the continuing FTX fraud investigation. So I think it's one of the great questions that befuddles us and confounds us, whether you're regular folk like, you and I just hanging out here on the radio, or the literati among us, the higher ups that make the laws that we all are bound by. What constitutes the middle class? Think about that. You hear that all the time. You hear about working class, which is a phrase I hate, because working class is, you know, is made to denote some people that, you know, have to work a little harder than others. Maybe they're on a lower income tax plateau or lower wage plateau than some of us are. I mean, it's that the inference there is like upper class, you know, high income earners don't work. But that's another discussion for another day. But having said that, what constitutes middle class? And I know it'd be a different figure for a single filer, you know, a person just filing their income taxes, or for a couple, husband, wife, domestic partner, live-ins together, filing jointly, whatever, married and all that. Why am I asking this? Well, it's a fascinating story that's kind of bubbled up this week. And, of course, we were dealing with the 10-year remembrance yesterday of the tragedy at Sandy Hook in Newtown. So that kind of, overshadowed everything. But the governor the other day, and he kind of reiterated it a couple of days ago, he actually, shockingly, and I still don't know how many of the people in his own caucus are going to go for this, you know, the governor the other day said maybe it's time to cut. I know it's difficult to say, isn't it? Governor Lamont floating the idea of a middle-class income tax cut for next year. He said during a Q&A on Tuesday that I played on this program, the governor said, here's the quote. He was asked, I guess, about tax relief, if I remember correctly, from the Capitol Press Corps that was doing kind of this Zoom press conference here after some sort of announcement about expanding broadband in the state, which is a good thing. He said, quote, I'd like to think that now it's a lot simpler if we provide a middle-class tax cut that would be an income tax cut for people up to a certain number, say 150 or 200,000. Now, what I think he was referring to there is a combined income. In other words, when he said 150,000, that would mean likely, and that's the number you're seeing bounced around already, 150,000 for a couple, a married couple or whomever, cohabitating, filing jointly. All right, so 75 and 75 basically would be 150, right? 100 and 100 would be 200 grand. So the governor said that earlier this week. He said that on Tuesday. And he also made that assertion in remarks given to the Hartford Business Journal on Monday. So twice this week, the governor has floated, and I'm all for this. And what was I saying? Now, he obviously listens to me. You never know. Maybe he's streaming WICC600.com up there in the governor's mansion in the big office with a big leather chair there. You think? I don't know. Governor, good afternoon if you're listening to everybody up there in the governor's mansion, in the governor's office there. But that's interesting. A middle-class tax cut, the governor alluding to something like $150,000 or $200,000 bucks. Now, individually, that's not middle class. That, that certainly tickles into the government's definition of what upper class or high income earner would be, I guess. But if you take that $150,000 and you split it in half, $75,000. So the inference is that once you get, now let's peel this apart here. If you got 150, you know, combined couple, or you half that for an individual, that's 75. So the inference here is that if you make, and again, this is the way I tend to look at things, if you make $75,001, that $1 or $75,100 or $76,000, that puts you into an upper income bracket. Interesting. I don't know whether it does or not. I mean, I think sometimes, as even as I get older and older, I realize this more. It's really not how much money you make. It's what you do with it and how you save it, how you spend it, how disciplined or non-disciplined you are with it. But I put a question, actually I put a couple of questions up on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WICC600. Want to get your thought on this one to begin. Pretty simple. I think it's a pretty simple question. What should the income ceiling be for an individual or couple in any possible state income tax from Governor Ned Lamont? Now, he certainly sounds like he is acting like a rich white guy who lives in Fairfield County and is probably telling the lefties in his party to calm down, put a sock in it. We can't go crazy taxing all the time. Let's do a little something here, at least in the near future, the next 2 years, the next 4 years, and give people some honest relief here. And I agree with him on that, because he said this patchwork, you know, he was alluding to the patchwork of, you know, property tax relief and relief if you have a kid, which again are nice if you have a kid. Property tax relief is really nice if you own property. A cut, some sort of a cut or rebalancing on the property tax on vehicles, that's nice if you own a vehicle. But a lot of people, right, don't own a vehicle. A boatload of people don't own vehicles or property or have kids. So as I said in the previous months, if you don't fit these kind of artificial carve-outs, what kind of break do you get? So, obviously, the governor listening to me and maybe to other people saying, hey, why don't we just do something? Like I said earlier, can we just do something across the board so everybody benefits here? So you tell me, what should the income ceiling be for an individual or a couple in any possible state income tax cut from Governor Ned Lamont? And he is kind of floated. I know the figure being floated by the governor. You know, the limit would be $75,000 or below you would get, or I guess $74,999 and below, you'd still be considered eligible for a middle-class tax cut. But once you hit that $75,000 mark, oh, no, no, you're suddenly, you, ladies and gentlemen, are suddenly living the high life, right? 75 grand for an individual, 150 for a couple. So, you know, that's another thing, too. What to tether that to what the governor wants to do, what do you consider middle class or upper class? This kind of thing always fascinates me. What in your mind, in your minds, maybe your collective mind, what in your mind or minds constitutes middle class? And I know it's weird, right, to put dollar figures on this stuff. And I guess you have to. You I guess for spending purposes and for legislative purposes, you have to throw a dollar figure on there. I get it. But in your mind, what do you consider? Is it possible to put a hard dollar figure, a hard number on what largely, look, you got to make the money, I understand it, but what largely are lifestyle decisions from people? I mean, you could have somebody in a relatively low-paying job, but if they save and save and save, they could have a boatload of money in the bank. Then you could have someone in a, you know, relatively well-paying middle or lower upper-class job, and they spend every cent they have, and they have no money. So how do you figure that? Again, what should the income ceiling be? In other words, if the governor says and the legislature says, the majority Democrats say, this is what we're giving you now, you fine folk in Connecticut. What we're giving you now is a middle class tax cut. What's the upper level of middle class? You have an answer for that? Or is it the kind of thing where, like, hey, Paul, I can't put a number on it, but I know it when I see it? We had a tragic story a couple of days ago having to do with a woman in Milford who was killed by the father of one of her kids, and the victim tragically killed here. And as we got deeper into the story, turns out that she was a victim, obviously, of domestic violence. And, you know, details of that story starting to trickle out, including the fact that, you know, there were orders against the suspect here, which in the end, you know, didn't have all that much of an effect. And interesting story here in the Hearst, Connecticut papers, state lawmakers vowing to boost protections for survivors after Milford, a domestic homicide, the one we were talking about a few days ago, we were taking calls on here on the station. Another one of these moments where we look and we say, you know, is enough being done? And what can a woman do, no matter how many protection orders are out there, if she feels unsafe, no matter what the legal system is doing? Now, we can't speak specifically to this case because it's still being adjudicated, but we can speak on the larger issue here. Liza Andrews joins us. She's Director of Public Policy and Communications at the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Hey, Liza, it's Paul here. Good afternoon. How are you?
Hi, Paul. Good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for taking the time. I wanted to have somebody from your group on, Liza, because this is just a horrible situation. And I know we can't speak to the specifics of this, but the overriding, and I was talking about this with my callers the other day, Liza, the overriding message of something like this is that no matter how many restraining orders, protection orders, non-contact orders that are written, sometimes, thankfully not always, but sometimes those have very little, if any, effect, and it does lead to tragedy in a case like this. But I can just imagine, Liza, what you folks at the Coalition must hear from women over the years who have been in situations just like this.
Absolutely. I mean, there are abusers who are just relentless. And we're always, you know, doing our best to make sure that victims and survivors can get connected to services. We want them to know they're not alone. We want them to know there are tools and options out there to help keep them safe. The restraining order, protective orders, you know, those are an important piece, an important tool in the toolbox to stay safe when you're experiencing domestic violence. There's absolutely the fact that if the person who is being restrained by the order has no care for authority, the authority of the court, the authority of the judge, the authority of law enforcement, that does pose a problem. You know, and we have been saying, CCADV, our 18 member organizations, our Domestic Violence Fatality Review Task Force that CCADV runs, violations of restraining and protective orders are one of the biggest red flags for escalating violence and potentially fatal violence. If that individual that has been to court or been arrested and been told you can no longer contact this person, don't go anywhere near them, don't talk to them, and they still do it and they don't care that the court has told them not to do it, that's a serious red flag. And those are the cases that we really need to hone in on and make sure that those individuals are held accountable for their actions.
And coming off a horrible occurrence locally here in the greater Fairfield, New Haven County area a few weeks ago, where a mother of two was brutally and allegedly murdered by the father of one of her kids, more calls now to do something to increase funding, increase programming, and take a look at, in particular, the protections afforded to women who are dealing with domestic violence in the area. Liza Andrews continues with us, Director of Communications, speaking today for the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Liza, you know, this is a tough situation here where, as you said going into the break, you have a certain type of person, of offender, right, that won't heed any sort of directive from the court or from the DA or from the prosecutor, well, then what do we do?
I think we have to look, at the system as a whole about what to do with those individuals. You know, one thing that CCADV will propose this year is a large advisory council to look at holistically at the criminal justice response to domestic violence. So we want to look at the enhancement that the system needs. And violations of order are certainly, top of the list of things that need to be looked at. We want to look at domestic violence dockets. Those are, systems where it's the same judge, same prosecutor, same victim advocate working on the case, as the person moves through the system, to make sure that they're not going in front of different judges who maybe don't know, different prosecutors who maybe don't know about the other situation. So those are the types of things that we want to look at and get all the people around the table who really understand and know the system and how we can fix the system to catch these situations before they turn fatal.
That's interesting, Liza, that you just brought that up. So is that a concern of your organizations that people should know about, that maybe there is a problem here that you touched on, that we have sometimes judges and other court officials who are not as familiar with certain cases as they should be?
I think that, Connecticut has been a leader on creating protections for domestic violence victims. But there's always room for improvement. So what can we look at? What innovative changes and enhancements can we make? What's the cost of those changes? And where do we want to, invest to make sure that victims of domestic violence aren't dying?
What about the funding aspect of this, Liza? Is there enough funding here in the state for, say, shelters or some sort of housing that can be used in the short term or in the intermediate term if a woman is in fear of her safety, of herself and or her kids and their lives?
Sure. I mean, funding for domestic violence organizations, like many nonprofits, can certainly be challenging. Right now, domestic violence organizations really across the country, not just here in Connecticut, are facing reductions in federal Victim of Crime Act funding that funds all of our court-based advocates. It's the sole source of funding for the statewide domestic violence hotline. It funds all of our law enforcement advocates who work with their local police departments to improve the law enforcement response to domestic violence. The shelter funding last year, our shelters ran at 149% capacity. The year before, 156% capacity. One source of funding we're always looking for is increased funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development that funds rapid rehousing, which is essentially a transitional housing program for victims of domestic violence, so that we can get them. No one wants to live in a shelter. Shelter living is not ideal. It's an absolute necessity and something to be considered when someone's in immediate danger. But we also want to be able to move that victim and her or his children onto a safe, permanent location. So that's what we hope to do with rapid rehousing. But we're always looking for funding for these initiatives.
You just said something well over, 100% for a couple of years, 149, 150%, something like that. So the money is one thing, but by those occupancy figures you gave me there, Liza, it certainly sounds like just the physical footprint of such shelters needs to be or would likely be expanded to be effective, right?
Right. Well, not necessarily the shelter space itself. I think one of the biggest challenges that we face here in Connecticut is access to affordable housing so that we can transition individuals out of shelter more quickly into housing they can afford, even if they can, what they need to afford it is a temporary rental subsidy from us, from the money from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. But that is a big challenge. They come into shelter and then it can be difficult to move them out because there's no affordable housing to move them into.
Mm. The website, folks, if you want to check this out, if you need their services or want more information, ctcadv.org. That is ctcadv.org. org. And Liza Andrews has been the guest. Liza is the Director of Public Policy and Communications for the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Liza, thank you. Good to speak with you after a few years, and we'll definitely be in touch down the road. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul.
Appreciate it. Liza Andrews there from the Connecticut Coalition Against Domestic Violence. And once again, the website, ctcadv.org. That is ctcadv.org. All right, let's talk a little economics, shall we? Because in and of the soap opera, it is every day. It's always kind of interesting. Welcoming back right now, David Sacco. He's been with us before. He's an instructor in finance, economics, and all that at the University of New Haven. Hey, David, it's Paul here on WICC. Good afternoon. Good to have you back. How are you?
Good, Paul. How are you?
I'm doing well. First, before we get to the FTX soap opera, which seems to be changing minute by minute, what do you think of what's going on Wall Street here, David? What the Fed is doing? They raised rates again the other day, which could make it a little bit more expensive for you and I to do our everyday business. What are your thoughts on where we stand right now in the general economy?
Absolutely. So the Fed is doing what it can to basically reduce inflation. And, you know, unfortunately, the way it reduces inflation is by slowing the economy. So, yes, you're right there. They're doing things that are causing interest rates to go up, which does cost people more money in their day-to-day life in the hopes that it'll bring inflation down and bring prices back, you know, to stop rising as fast and causing as much harm. You know, their strategy, you know, the analogy is the economy is a car barreling down a highway and it's going too fast and you're trying to slow it down. And what they've been doing over the past 6 months is essentially pumping the brakes. And the first few times they pumped them really hard, i.e. raising rates by 75 basis points. This time they pumped them a little less hard, 50. And what they're doing is slowing the rate of rate increases so that they can see what effect it's having on the economy, right? When the Fed takes this action, there's a lag, so they want to monitor what's going on in the economy to assess how effective it's been before they do more.
So what do you think? And David, I have heard over the past couple of days there are still some people out there, although cautiously, they're using the R word, recession. What are your thoughts?
Well, by definition, what the Fed tries to do is to create an economic slowdown, which, you know, it's semantics, but that is a recession. So, you know, at some level, and I think the way the market's behaving is telling you, the quicker we get to the recession, the quicker we can start getting out of the recession. And I think that's what the market's looking for. Obviously, the Fed doesn't want it to be, you know, too deep of a recession, because obviously that has a negative impact on people's lives and living standards. But they have to cause enough of a slowdown to ease that pressure on prices.
David Sacco, one of our regular guests here, when all things turn to the economy, big and small, local, state, national. David, an instructor on finance, economics, and all that at the University of New Haven. Let's turn, David, to this FTX scenario, which is now playing out like a soap opera every day. Maybe there'll be a streaming series on this, I'm sure. Hey, listen, if they can do Succession, they can do this. David, in your thought here, were you one of the financial people, and I've heard this from a lot of folks I've had on the show and talked to on social media, was something like what happened to FTX, David, was it just a matter of time? Is this an I told you so moment, or did this not have to happen?
You know, I've seen plenty of these scenarios throughout my career, you know, which spans back into the early 80s. And what always amazes me is that, you know, the story's the same, right? It's just a case of someone essentially stealing other people's assets. You know, there's always a new twist because it's always some sort of, you know, new financial product or new technology. But the crime is always the same. And you know, I think part of it is it's easy to do stuff like this when people are getting enamored by high returns. So, you know, a new financial asset comes up, the value goes up quite a bit. People get all excited about it, throw a lot of money at it. And, you know, some unscrupulous participant figures out a way to sort of take advantage of that greed that's drawing people in, and then basically steals their money, which is really what went on in this case.
I, David, have interviewed a bunch of people on this locally, nationally, and they're kind of split down the middle. More regulation is needed here, but some are saying, hey, just less regulation, but if you make the whole blockchain tracking sort of mandatory. Any thoughts on that?
so I you know, my thoughts on regulation is that when we regulate the financial industry, we do it because we want to provide a sense of security to investors and depositors, which is a good thing. The flip side of that is when you regulate and or the government guarantees people's money when they invest it, it allows people to sort of not do as much due diligence on their own. And again, an unscrupulous character can take advantage of that. So I'm kind of torn. I mean, this is just fraud and criminal activity. And I'm not sure, you know, we've seen this happen in regulated spaces before as well. So I'm not sure that is necessarily the answer.
Where, hey, I'm sorry, I have to ask you this, and you're probably going to laugh when you hear the question. I'm kind of doing this rhetorically. Where's all the money, David? Now we know where some of it went, apparently, but that's a lot of money still unaccounted for out there in this whole thing.
It is. I mean, and it's, you know, I think some of it, you know, they took customer assets and used them as collateral in this trading entity, and I think some of that just got lost in, you know, in market swings. Some of it sounds like they were spending on, you know, personal things and houses and paying themselves money. And frankly, a lot of it, and this is where I think it's going to get interesting. I mean, you know, the stories that I've read have suggested that he made between $500 million and $1 billion worth of political contributions. you know, are the politicians going to pay that money back?
Well, yeah, and that, David, that's great because that has been floated like in any other scenario, right, with a RICO statute or something like that. There would be calls, hue and cries, oh, my God, pay back the money. Congress has been oddly kind of quiet on that, David, hasn't it? And he says he made them to both sides, right?
Oh, yeah. The good thing about this is you can be assured that the donations were bipartisan. And again, we'll be interested to see if folks gave the money back. The other thing that I thought was interesting was the timing of his arrest. Right. He was basically scheduled to testify at a House hearing that very day. And I've read, you know, a lot of prosecutors who have said, well, you know, any good prosecutor would have loved to have seen him get up there for 5 or 6 hours under oath and testify because it would have just given them more ammunition. And yet they arrested him right before he could do that. So I'm sure there's a lot more to the story than we know right now.
David Sacco is the guest. David, the thing that bothers me in this whole thing, and that makes it really greasy, is that you had some pretty high-profile promotion of this stuff. In fact, somebody's actually sued. I don't know whether you saw the story. I think a local investor is actually suing Tom Brady because he was a spokesman for FTX. Larry David did a commercial for them. FTX had a sponsorship on Major League Baseball umpires' game shirts. They were sponsoring an arena. That really bothers me. And I know it's caveat emptor, but, you know, when people see well-known stars, David, and a sports league getting in bed with this, I mean, you almost can't blame people if they get taken on this.
Well, there's that. And then to your point, where the money went, he obviously paid all of those celebrities and, you know, paid for sponsoring deals. Are those celebrities and those sports teams? You know, his logo was on Major League umpire shirt all year.
Yeah.
You know, so is Major League Baseball going to pay back that money so some of these duped investors can get their money back? Is Tom Brady? Is Larry David? And again, not that they had anything to do with the fraud, you know, and the embezzlement, but it was the credibility that their sponsorship brought him that, you know, at least probably got some people to get involved in this. So these are all questions that are going to, you know, test us. You know, this is sort of like the Bernie Madoff situation, right? When Bernie Madoff did his thing, a lot of people invested with Bernie Madoff because he was generating these ridiculously high returns. So, you know, if you're generating returns that are too good to be true, you're right. Whose fault is it if you're jumping on that bandwagon and then you lose money? But this one has a lot of tentacles, and it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out.
David, thank you. David Sacco, instructor, finance, economics, and all that. University of New Haven, high on the hill there in West Haven. David, thanks. Good to speak with you. Have a happy new year, happy holidays, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you.
Same to you and your listeners, Paul. Take care.
Appreciate it. Thank you. David Sacco, UNH instructor, finance, economics, accounting, and all that. Yeah, somebody is suing, I think Tom Dudchick had it up on the Capital Report, some investor, and it wasn't his life savings, or it may have been, I don't know, he invested $30,000 with FTX, And I guess the lawsuit is, you know, he's basing his suit. I think he's actually suing Tom Brady. And so, yeah, see, that's, and look, it's easy for me to say, right, sitting here where nobody, believe me, I have never been a spokesperson for anybody. I mean, I cut commercials sometimes, but I don't like, hey, it's Paul Pacelli here for, American Asphalt. God, when I have a crack to fill, I use American Asphalt. No, I mean, but you can imagine some of these stars get big money. Do they do research into this stuff? Do they have management and team and, you know, okay, hey, Larry, somebody was offering you $2 million to do that. Well, is this legit? Or am I going to be steering people? Or maybe, you know, they say, hey, what's the problem going to be? Oh, I steered you the wrong way? Come after me, right?